This is a podcast from the University of Manchester's Jodrell Bank Center for Astrophysics. For the full show and archives, visit jodcast.net.
Hi, I'm here today with Dr. Federico Oban from KBFI. Welcome to the Jodcast.
Thank you.
Yeah, it's good to have you here. And you've been in Manchester today giving a talk on your research into bigravity, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
Could you start off by telling us what that is to begin with?
Okay, so bigravity is an extension of general relativity, where instead of having one particle that propagates gravity, you have two particles. So it's a relatively new achievement that's been written down only in 2012.
Okay.
Yeah. So people are exploring the possibilities of bigravity and see how it applies to cosmology and astronomy and particle physics.
And what's the motivation behind it?
So people were trying to get a theory where gravity had, instead of a massless field that propagates gravity. So gravity is a long-range force, which means that the particle that propagates gravity has no mass, like a photon. So people were trying to figure out if it was possible to write a theory of gravity where the particle would have a mass,
okay,
like an electron. And it turned out that it was nearly impossible. So people struggled with it for 80 years because of the so-called ghost problems. So every time they were writing some theory with the mass for this graviton field, it turned out that some of these particles that were propagating were so-called ghosts, which means they had negative energy.
Oh.
Yeah. Which was problematic, because then everything can decay into a negative energy and the world would end in a second. And
yeah, but it definitely doesn't sound.
Yeah.
Right. So this is the solution to that problem?
Yeah, so people were looking at this, how to write this massive gravity theory, and then they realized that the only way was to introduce an extra metric, an extra particle, and the only way is to actually have two. So one with no mass and one with mass. So both of them are dynamic fields. And
what do you mean by that?
It means that they propagate, they interact, and they're not just background or reference, not mathematical tricks. So if you want to have a massive gravity, then you need to have a bigravity. Almost.
Okay.
This is like almost true. You can engineer massive gravity only, but it's
not very
much more natural to have both.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And so you're saying one of the motivations for it originally came from, so massive gravity originally was looking at the range of the force and stuff.
The motivation was purely theoretical. People were thinking, okay, we have a theory for spin 2, like gravity is a theory of a spin 2 particle, as electrons have spin 1/2, and the photons have spin 1. And people were just curious. Can we have it massive? And it turned out no, so people got even more curious. Why can we have it massive? So, and then it took about 80 years to finally fix it. But it all started in the 30s with Fisk and Pauli. So in 2012, people managed to write down the theory where there's one field without a mass and one field with a mass. Both of them have spin 2, so they both behave as gravity. And that's the theory that we've been playing with.
What's your motivation for doing it? That could be a good question or not, I'm not sure.
Well, I've always been interested in gravity and extensions of gravity. And the original motivation was actually quite funny, because some time ago, maybe a year and a half ago, I believe, there was a claim from the LHC accelerator in Geneva that there may be a new particle.
Oh.
You know, it's been pretty boring, because all they found was what we knew was supposed to be there. So they said, oh, look, there might be something at around 750 GeV, so a relatively high mass. And then the whole particle physics community jumped on it, because they were trying to figure out what it could be. And then I thought, oh, maybe it's not particle physics, maybe it's gravity. Because I knew about this bigravity, and then I thought, wait, maybe this is a graviton. And so I started thinking maybe we can reproduce the signal at the LHC with this particle. Turns out that it's almost impossible, but in the process of working with this, we thought, wait a minute, we can do dark matter with it.
Oh, and how does that work?
Well, because, you know, you start thinking about having a heavy particle, a new heavy particle, and then this heavy particle doesn't work for accelerator physics, but then you have a new heavy particle. And we know that the universe is missing one heavy particle that interacts very weakly with the rest of matter. So it's a natural, I believe, a natural association. You have a new heavy particle, it comes out of this theory. You didn't invent it for that, but this just works very well for the dark matter problem.
That's like an interesting story, right? Because a lot of the proposed solutions for dark matter are very much engineered. They're very
kind
of pushed into it going, oh God, how do we get this? And so this more naturally fell out.
It's an awesome thing. I mean, you know, people could have thought maybe we should add a spin 2 particle as dark matter, and then eventually they would have come up with the right theory for gravity, the right theory for this extension of gravity. But of course it would have been much more counterintuitive. in some sense, people in theory, they were trying to get this theory right. And then, well, at least we have a new particle, let's do something with it.
That makes sense. Yeah. And so you mentioned a couple of times it's a spin 2 particle, the one massive and one massless particle. What does that mean for our listeners, like spin 2 rather than, say, spin 1/2 or spin 1 or spin 2?
In technical terms, it's related to how many states you can have for a given particle. Like, we know that, for example, the electron has spin 1/2, so the quantum states available for the electron are spin up or spin down. The internal rotation or angular momentum of the electron can either be spinning in one way, like up, or spinning down, which means that if you use your right hand, for example, you close your right hand and you call this, like, spinning the way you close your right hand, you call it up, and spinning the way you close your left hand, you're spinning down. Right? Or just, so that's the two states available to an electron. A photon has three spin states because it has spin 1. Mm-hmm. So spin 1, you can go from 1 to minus 1 and in integers, because spin is quantized in integers. Mm-hmm. So there is 1 minus 1, and in the middle there is 0. So a photon can go like the same, go up, can go down, and it can have 0 spin. And a graviton has spin 2, which means that you have 5 available spin states. If you have a massive graviton, then you have 5 available spin states, and then you can have spin plus 2, plus 1, 0, minus 1, plus 2. That's what it means technically. And it's sort of thinking of how many ways this particle can have internal angular momentum, how many ways this can internally rotate, which is related to the background symmetry of your theory.
So if we think of kind of the, what I would call it, the traditional Big Bang story, beginning of the universe, how does bigravity fit into that narrative?
Okay, so the bigravity can reproduce most of the traditional Big Bang story. Mm-hmm. So if we have a theory that is bigravity instead of Einstein gravity, then you're able, for all of the late universe history, you can reproduce it almost exactly. Well, as exactly as we would be able to probe. So as far as that is concerned, there isn't really not that much that is new in that theory. I mean, of course, you can always make some differences, okay? This theory has a little bit more leverage, so you can try to make a different history, but then you don't want to conflict with what we already know about it. And the difficult part is the very early universe. Because the very early universe, we don't know. There are some instabilities in this bigravity theory at very high energy, and still work in progress. So people don't really know whether we are able to write down a full history of the universe in this theory, or whether we need to resort to some other theory that, that would complete it at higher energy.
And it's still early days, right? You're saying it's only been around for 5 years.
It is early days, yes. And the community that is working on it is still surprisingly small, because there are a lot of cosmologists that are interested in it, because it's like the first obvious natural application to of a gravity theory is cosmology. But it's a still relatively small community, I think maybe about 30 people that really work on it.
No, I think it definitely does sound pretty fascinating. The thing that really struck me was you were saying that there's no conflicts with the universe now on large scales as we see.
Yes, exactly.
Especially if you're looking at it from the dark matter point of view, lots of the other candidates, they make changes to the small scale structure.
Yes, yes, exactly.
Galaxies and so on, and that's a big debate that's going on.
Yes, yes.
So I thought that was particularly interesting. As a dark matter candidate, in this idea, has dark matter always existed? When did it come into existence? Does it decay? Does it interact? Like, how much do you know about it?
If this theory is right, then we have a limited amount of freedom, as opposed to WIMPs, so to standard dark matter candidates, or to like most of the more popular ones, where you have so many knobs that you can turn and to make sure that everything works. So in this case, we have a mass that we can choose, and we have this self-coupling, this non-linear coupling. And it turns out that there's only very, very limited range of these parameters that we can use. So within this range, you make sure that the dark matter is produced in the very early universe with the right abundance, and you make sure that it doesn't decay too much. So it may decay. We actually hope it does decay to some level, so that we can actually see some of the products of it. Otherwise, it will be completely invisible always and forever. But it's something that can be erased, and it turns out that it's a very limited number of parameter space region that you can have so that this model works. So the dark matter would be produced very early in the universe via some mechanism that is called freezing. So it's something that I explained a bit in my talk. Essentially, you start with zero dark matter and your very hot thermal bath, and then this hot thermal bath is leaking very slowly, leaking some dark matter particles. So while the thermal bath is cooling down because the universe expands, the amount of dark matter is slowly crawling up because it's leaking out of the thermal bath. And at some point, the universe is cold enough that this leaking process stops. It's no longer efficient, so you cannot produce anymore. And this is called the freezing, so the amount freezes to some level. And this stays until today, or until it starts decaying. And you can show that you can produce enough, and then you can also decay slowly enough that this model is viable.
Yeah, which gives you that parameter space left to
In which case you have a small parameter space that you hope to be able to probe. This generation of experiments is already probing quite a bit, and then hopefully the optimistic me would say a few years, the pessimistic me maybe 10, 12 years, we should be able to actually check the whole of this parameter space and say, okay, this does make sense or this is completely wrong.
But I mean, in the realm of what at least I know about theoretical physics, and especially where particle physics and cosmology collide, 10, 12 years to have your theory tested is not actually that long.
I know, it is, it is a good, but again, I am not an experimentalist, so experimentalists may call me out on that and say, no, wait, it will take 30.
Well,
it's still a human life scale.
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, some of my colleagues were talking about your talk, and they said, wow, it was testable.
It is testable,
because that's what we need for theory, so it's quite exciting to see that. So what are the tests that you're particularly interested to
hear? Yeah, the most straightforward one would be the decay. So we know that this dark matter couples to all the particles we know, so photons and protons and, well, at the fundamental level, quarks and neutrinos. So it will decay, we just don't know how rapidly that would happen. We have a limit on it because it cannot happen too rapidly because we would have seen it already. But this can decay, and so the way to see this particle would be to look for the decay products. So this particle would decay into two identical photons, for example, or into two identical neutrinos, or two identical electrons, I mean electron and anti-electron. And if this particle is very heavy, as we think it is, then it would decay into very, very highly energetic photons or neutrinos. So these particles would start off with a huge energy, and it would travel through the plasma, through the gas, from the dwarf galaxy or the center of the galaxy, from wherever these particles are mostly concentrated, and then they would produce. They travel through, and then they make a very peculiar signal where you see in the spectrum that you see from, for example, the Fermi Observatory, which is looking at the photons, the high energetic photons that come from the sky. You would see a peak, which is the injection, so the particle that decays into these two photons directly. And then some of these photons, as they travel, they will lose their energy because they interact with the gas, like with the electrons, with the CMB photons, the background photons. And then they will produce a shoulder in the spectrum, okay? So you will have the energy here, sorry, the energy here and the intensity, like energy on the x-axis and intensity on the y-axis. And then you will see like a peak and a shoulder. So this is what Fermi is looking for. It's looking for pieces of the spectrum. Now, the good thing is that if you see some of these photons, which we haven't seen yet, if you see some of these photons, then automatically in this model, you know also where you should look for the neutrinos, because the coupling is given. So everything couples in the same way, because it's gravity. So you cannot choose, oh, I want the neutrinos, but I don't want the photons. It's not an option here. So in some sense, this is
that's good,
a peculiar signature for it.
Yeah. And it also means that, say, if you did detect the photons, but then you couldn't get the neutrinos where you thought they were, then
then you would also know that's wrong.
So what are you particularly interested in your field over the next couple of years? What do you see as the next big developments?
You mean for this, in this microgravity business?
That or more generally, whatever you're excited about.
Well, okay, for this, microgravity is still very interesting because there are a lot of other possibilities, like exploring this microgravity in terms of particle physics, which is completely new, because most of the microgravity community comes from gravitational physics, and there is very little interaction, surprisingly, between gravitational people and particle physics people. So there could be interesting consequences for particle physics if you can play with this microgravity theory. So that's one interesting thing to look at. And the other one is what this microgravity can do with all the gravitational waves experiments. So, for example, we know that gravitational waves exist. We know that spin two particles exist because we have detected them. And microgravity introduces one more spin two particles. And in strong gravity systems, there may be a lot more to discover in this field.
Yeah, so I suppose you've still got quite a lot to explore then.
There is definitely a lot to explore. One of the challenges is that microgravity, being a gravity theory, is technically
difficult.
Complex.
Yeah.
Because you have a lot of indices that you have to keep track of, and it's non-linear, which means there's no easy way to simplify it. There's no easy way to take an approximation and work out some simple solutions first and then increase in complexity until you get a more and more refined solution. You have to just find the full solution. And it's a lot more challenging.
Sounds like a lot of work, yeah. Well, thank you for coming on the Judgecast, and hopefully we'll have you back in the future.
Thank you very much.